Hi, I'm Ken Rimple of Chariot Solutions, and welcome to the Philly Emerging Technologies for the Enterprise podcast number 3 for 2011. Today's speaker is Mike Brocious. He's a lead architect at VisiBiz, a business development solution for small businesses that incorporates networking activities, social infusion, and intelligence and workflow into traditional CRM. Mark's talk is called How MongoDB Helps VisiBiz Tackle Social CRM. This talk is a case study of MongoDB at VisiBiz, why they selected it, how they're using it, going over the schema design, going over the application architecture. And then he takes a look at some of the secondary uses for it as well. It's a great discussion of MongoDB inside an enterprise architecture. Let's give it a listen. Chariot is sponsoring a one-day practical DevOps seminar on October 18th, 2011. Learn how to tightly integrate your development and operations experts and improve the quality and rapidity in producing your software. The one-day, $99 conference includes talks from Sonatype's Jason Van Zyl, CloudBees, Puppet Labs, and two real-world case studies from Fortune 500 companies. The show will wrap up with a panel discussion that will take your questions from each of our speakers. Don't miss this highly informative, low-cost event. More information is available at chariotsolutions.com/devops-seminar or by clicking the DevOps seminar link on techcast.chariotsolutions.com. Hope to see you there.
My name is Mike Brocious. I'm the tech lead at VisiBiz. I'm going to basically take you through a pretty brief discussion about MongoDB, how it fits into the application, and why we chose it. I'm going to start off with a little bit of good news. It is Thursday afternoon, 4 o'clock, a long couple of days, and everybody's tired or brain dead at this point. So the good news is I only have probably about 30, 35 minutes worth of slides, so I'm not going to keep you from happy hour today. Feel free to ask a few questions. We'll have plenty of time for that, but we should get out of here in pretty good time. So again, what we're going to go through is the first half will basically be why we chose MongoDB. And then we'll talk about how we're using it. We'll talk about what we've learned along the way, because it wasn't a perfect road trip. It wasn't smooth everywhere. And we'll show that right up front. We'll talk about specifically some of the collections that we have within the application. And I'll show you examples of our schema. So what do the objects look like that we're actually storing within Mongo? Obviously, feel free to stop me at any time. Feel free to ask questions. Just to set a little bit of the context, we are a small startup company. We've been around for about a year now. We're located in Malvern, Chester County, 45 minutes west of here. The application itself is in the social CRM space, so it's a relationship management tool with an infusion of information coming from social networks, email. We'll probably eventually get into blogs and articles and things like that. It's really targeted at individuals, entrepreneurs, small businesses right now. Our catchphrase is know your network, sell better. So the idea is we want to help you understand the context, the people that are in your network, so you know them better, therefore you can target them better and you can sell to them better. We are currently in a limited or private beta, so if at the end of the presentation I haven't scared you away and you still like what you see, feel free to go to the website and you can get signed up for it. A little more context, just about from a physical architecture standpoint. The application that I'm going to be talking about is a Grails app. So a Grails application ends up getting built into a WAR file. We're deploying that into Tomcat. We're front-ending that with Apache. Obviously, we have MongoDB as our back-end data store. We recently added Elasticsearch as our full-text search engine. MongoDB right now does not have full-text search. They've been talking about it for quite a while. I attended the MongoDB conference that was here on Tuesday, and as of right now, it's still two releases out. So it's going to be several more months until they get a full-text search. So we went ahead and added Elasticsearch to our architecture. We're deploying that on a Unix image on top of the always rock-solid, always available Amazon EC2 cloud. Right? I'm sure we probably weren't the only ones in this room that got burned a little bit by the Amazon fund that happened last week. Full disclosure, we're small. Like I said, just getting started. So we have a limited number of users on our system right now. So we have a single server, which right now is combined. It's got the application and the database on it. We're working on getting it scaled out, but with a limited number of users, startup company, we're focusing on feature and functionality first, and then we'll start to scale out. But right now we're not big. We're not spread across multiple servers. Okay, so how did we get to Mongo? basically, it started with requirements from the application standpoint. And there's really two that we're going to talk about that, were the primary factors that really led us in the direction of Mongo. The first one is extensibility. We want our customers to be able to extend the core domain objects that we're providing within the application. We also want customers to be able to define their own objects, plug them into our application so that it kind of helps them tailor our application to their use. The other point was scalability. I mentioned that the application does harvest social media, social networks, so there's a lot of that out there, so we're going to be getting into large amounts of data. So it was important to us that from day one, the data store that we chose had the scalability designed in it. So from an extensibility standpoint, I'm going to put my product manager hat on just for a second. The application is in the relationship management space, and relationship management crosses a whole bunch of different businesses, right? Whether you're a realtor, you're a DJ, a VC fund manager, a shoe salesman, you know, all those kinds of different businesses have network of contacts, right? So our application really needs to be able to fit into a bunch of different vertical markets. So if I put on my architect or developer hat, what that means for me is that in addition to the core objects that we're going to provide, like a person or a company, a prospect, and so forth, we really want customers to be able to add their own attributes and therefore their own meaning to our objects. And this, again, is going to help them take our application, customize it, fit it into their workflow better. Dropping down another level, what this really means for us is that a person object might not have the same shape for two different customers. Multi-tenant, we're going to have multiple customers running in our database. A person might not look like or might not look the same across those two different customers. So just to spell this out, core attributes in a person schema across two different customers, name, address, and date of birth would be common across everybody. Customer number one is interested in tracking the employment history. So they've added a list of, you know, company, begin date, and job title. Customer number two is more interested in, are they male or female? What are their hobbies? What are their interests, right? So here's an example where these two customers have extended our core attributes and added their own. Not only do we want customers to be able to extend our objects, but we also want them to be able to define their own. And so if they can define their own and basically plug them into our app, then that helps them even further get our application to then fit into their world. Now, obviously, since we don't, as the company writing this application, we don't know about those objects right up front, we're not going to be able to code business logic around them. But if they can add relationships between our objects and their objects, then we can retrieve those objects, bring them back, show them in lists, and so forth, and things like that. The second point that I mentioned earlier was scalability. Again, we wanted to make sure that the data store that we went with was scalable right up front. So because we're going to be dealing with social networks, we are going to be getting into a lot of data. Most everybody in this room is probably a member of one or two, six or seven different social networks, right? I mean, there's so many of them out there. Most of us are members of a lot of them. So you kind of have a feeling for how much data is really available in these social networks. We're going to be going beyond the social networks, getting into blogs and articles and so forth. Again, the purpose of our application is to help you know your network better. So we're going to try to glean as much information as we can about the people that are in your network to really help you know them better. So scalability is important to us because we're going to be getting into a large amount of data. Yes, question?
The blue attributes on your previous slide, is there any business
requirement
for people to have to be able to change those for
their individual contact? No, we haven't talked about that. Specifically, it's more just adding additional attributes to that core set. I thought there was another question. Okay. Sorry. The second point with scalability is we want the scalability of our data store to be relatively easy. So we don't want it to be rocket science for us as app guys. We want to be able to basically focus on the application feature function and not on those minute details about how to take a database and, you know, spray it across 10 or 12 servers. We really want to focus on the application itself. So with that as a backdrop, again, there were a lot of things that we talked about, a lot of requirements that went into it, but those two, the extensibility and scalability, those were the two most important things for us. So we did the research. We looked at the data stores that are out there. We looked at the relational, the NoSQL. We looked at the key value data stores and so forth. We did enough research to where we kind of whittled it down. We grabbed a couple of them, downloaded them, wrote some code against them, tried to get a feeling for each of them. We looked at the website. We looked at the documentation, looked at the forums to try to get a feeling for how active are these products. Some of them are very, very active, and some of them weren't so active, and so that kind of might, you know, give you a pause. I'm not really going to talk about the other data stores. You could probably take any data store and make it work for almost any problem. I'm not going to talk about those guys. I'm really just going to kind of focus on what was it we liked about Mongo. The first point is that Mongo is a document data store. The really cool thing about this for us is that it makes your data so easy to visualize. I came from many, many years of row and column world. Now I'm working in the document data store, and when you do queries and get the data back, whether it's in a command line shell, whether it's in a log file, even if you're in the debugger and or viewers, seeing it in a document makes it so much easier to kind of put that whole object together than it is in the row and column world. The second point for us is that Mongo is schema-free, schema-less. It supports dynamic schemas. And what that means is that you don't have to define the shape of your objects right up front. You don't have to tell it that I've got a name that's broken into a first name and last name. I don't have to tell it that those are strings. And so that gives you a lot of flexibility. And obviously, this is going to fit well with the extensibility requirements that I mentioned earlier. Since we're going to be supporting person objects that might look very different across customers, having that dynamic schema nature really, really fit well for us. We're going to have lots of other challenges probably to support that extensibility. Mongo won't be one of them, and that was really key for us. So to kind of point this out, I put together a little bit of an illustration what it would be like to try to support an extensible person object in a relational database and in a document database. And this is going to bring together both points as far as what data looks like in a document data store and the benefits of the schema-free nature. So in this example, we've got a person object that we want to extend differently for different customers. So the first table up there is basically the core attributes, name, address, date of birth. The second table there are the user-defined attributes. So that's where the extensions come into play. The third table is a metadata table that basically tells you information about what's in that second table. There are probably several different ways of solving this problem. This is just one example here that I've seen actually implemented in previous projects. And so you've got all of the data there. As a human looking at this, you can kind of piece it all together, especially in this example because it's pretty small. Imagine if you've got hundreds of columns, thousands or millions of rows, whatever, and you're trying to put all this together when you're trying to support it. It's not intuitive to us. Contrast that with a document, and this is a document that came right out of the command line query for Mongo. There I've got my Mike Brosh's person object, name, address, date of birth right up front. I've got the employment history right there with it. It's very clear that that employment history goes with Mike Brosh's. And you can see that it's a list there. And so that is very, very easy to read, to figure out, again, whether you're looking at it in a log file, a viewer, whatever. And here is a person object that has the gender and hobbies along with it, not the employment history. Again, very, very easy. You can see that those attributes are nested right there. And because Mongo is schema-free, I can take those two documents, insert them into the same collection, which is basically a table, insert them into the same collection, and now I can do queries across all those objects. I didn't have to tell Mongo, hey, I've got gender over here that's a string. I just created that object, gave it to Mongo, and Mongo wrote it for me. What else did we like about Mongo? Scalability, right? That was one of the things that we were really looking for. If you don't know, the name Mongo comes from humongous. And so Tengen, which is the company that is writing Mongo, had it in mind right up front. It supports replication, which is almost trivial to set up. You can actually set up a master-slave replica in about a minute if you know what you're doing with the files. And it also supports sharding. In our environment, we have a replica set up, and that's how we're doing backups. We're doing backups off of our slave, not off of the master. I mentioned that we're small right now. We're only on a single server. Our slave is on a second server, actually. We have not gotten into sharding yet, so I don't have any real-world hands-on experience that I can talk about with that yet. I read about it, attended a couple of webinars. It doesn't seem like it's going to be that big a deal. There will probably be some application changes for us because we need to get into defining sharding keys and a few other things, but it doesn't scare me. The second point is that Mongo uses JSON, and JSON is real easy to build, to parse, to read. I think one of the team members one day said it's the new XML. It's been around for, I don't know, 8 or 10 years or so, and it's really, really popular. It's got great support from most of the tools that we're using. A lot of the programming languages have support for it. A lot of the web services that are out there that are available on the internet, like Yahoo and Flickr and so forth, they're supporting JSON. So JSON is everywhere. For us, this was actually a really key point, because when we took a look at all the major components that are in our application stack, we realized that they're all supporting JSON. So from the database, which is Mongo, and Mongo stores its database in BSON, which is the binary format of JSON, and it returns the data in JSON format, to Groovy, which you can use the map syntax, and you can very easily take JSON documents, throw them into a map, and now you can access them just using the map syntax. Grails has a JSON builder built into it, so you can easily create JSON documents that you can then send back. And we're using JavaScript on our client. Of course, the JS and JSON is JavaScript. So we have tremendous support in JSON top to bottom. I mentioned that we added Elasticsearch as our search engines. One of the reasons that we went with Elasticsearch was that it's a JSON-based search engine. So we're taking our JSON documents from Mongo, throwing them at Elasticsearch, it's doing the index and then searching for us. So it fits in, again, really, really well for us. So what this means, dropping down another level, is that because every layer of our application stack supports JSON, we're not really forced into transforming data between each of the layers. We're not taking database result sets, turning them into DOs or DTOs, shipping them up a couple levels. Once you get near to the presentation tier, you might have to then, you would normally have to take that data, transform it into something so you could serialize it, send it back, and then in the presentation tier, turn it into JavaScript objects. We're not doing any of that because it's JSON, basically top to bottom. What that lets you do is it lets you move a little bit faster. There's less code to write. There's less tests to write to actually test a lot of that transformation logic, so there's fewer moving parts there. I do want to say that you should not just take a JSON document that you get from your database and shuttle it all the way up to your UI. You've just taken your database schema and you've exposed it out there. And now if you need to refactor one or the other, it's going to force you to then refactor the other side of that. So you've got to be smart about it, and you can filter out objects as it goes up, but you're not doing transformations at that point. Everybody's dealing in JSON. Okay, one more slide about what we liked about Mongo. And basically, you can summarize it saying that it's a very active product. There's a lot of support out there from for plugins, drivers, viewers. It seems like every month there's another viewer that is announced on the Mongo mailing list. Tengen, which is the company that is writing Mongo, has tremendous support. You'll see that their developers are very active on their forums in Jira. You'll even see their CEO, who is still writing some of the code and fixing some of the bugs. He's very active on their forum. Mongo has a lot of conferences. Like every month or so, they're at a different corner of the world, basically hosting a conference. They were just here in Philly on Tuesday. Webcasts. And if you look, there's a really deep list of sites that are currently using Mongo. There's a couple of really big names out there. Folks have it. I've heard of a couple of sites that have it spread across 100 different boxes, you know, hosting 150 terabytes worth of data. So there's a lot of sites using it. It gives it a pretty good feeling that it's here, it's popular, and it's going to be around for quite a while. Okay. Of course, nothing's free, nothing's perfect, right? So with Mongo, you've got to be aware that there are no transactions, and it doesn't support what I would call really complex queries. You don't have join support, and you don't have the ability to do nested selects. So we looked at this, and coming from a background of dealing with medical data for many, many years, transactions were obviously part of my life. It took me a little while to get comfortable with the idea that I don't have transactions in my database. With the appropriate schema design, you can minimize the risk there, and you can mitigate it entirely in some cases. And we'll talk about a little bit one of the use cases that we came across and how we dealt with it. So after a while, we really felt that we could minimize the impact, and we thought that the benefits that we got from the extensibility and from the scalability outweighed this. Okay, so that is basically why we chose Mongo. I'm just going to get into how it fits into the application. From a layer standpoint, again, we are a Grails app, which is basically Groovy sitting on top of Java. So we wrote a Mongo service, which is a homegrown wrapper that sits right on top of the Java driver. And it's really just a convenience driver for us. It does a little bit of extra logging, coercion of data types when necessary. We are now also looking at Morphia, which is a lightweight object mapping library. So most of our code is still going through Mongo service, but we are looking at, we've put Morphia in maybe for 20 to 30% of our code. I think that we like what we see so far. And I talked to the folks at TenGen at their Mongo conference on Tuesday, and they recently hired the Morphia author at TenGen. So I said, yay, that was good. That's good. It's good for them and good for us. From a collection standpoint, we have probably 8 or 10 different collections. I'm really just going to kind of dive into two of them. We have Things and Rels. So Things is our main collection. The name Thing probably gives you an idea that it's not a single domain type object. We're not storing just a person or just a company in there. We're storing all kinds of different things. So it is the collection where we are storing those domain objects. Once we get into supporting customer-defined objects, we'll also be storing them within this collection. So this is where we're taking advantage of the schema-free nature of Mongo. We're going to be tossing persons and companies and events and notes and everything else just as things, putting them in there so that we can query across all of them. So just to give you an idea what a couple of things look like for us, this is just a real small snippet from a person thing. A couple of attributes that I'll mention. The thing type obviously gives us a clue what kind of thing this is. There's an owner attribute, which is the ID, the Mongo ID of the user who actually created this thing here. There's a created date, and those fields are pretty much common across all of our things. A person has a name. In this case, it's broken down into first name and last name. And then we have an array of tags, a list of mailing addresses, and a list of email addresses. If we look at a company thing, we see some of the core attributes. Again, thing type, owner, created date, and the underscore ID is the Mongo ID that it automatically assigns for you. So that's the unique key in this case. Primary business, which is just a short description about this company. And then the array of tags. So in Mongo syntax, if I want to do a query that basically says find all the things that I own, I do it like this, dbthings.find, where the owner is that ID and the tags array contains a tag called Java. And so Mongo makes it real easy. I'm going to query across all those different things. Doesn't matter whether the companies, persons, notes, whatever, that's the list that is going to come back to me. Question.
So, what is that return?
That is going to return a list of things that basically match that. Yeah. So I'm gonna get an array of JSON documents back from that. Yeah. You could certainly add another clause there that says where thing type is person. If I just want to get person objects back, person things back, right? So those are things. We also have relationships. Relationships for us are basically connections between things. So the employment history is an example of a relationship that would be between a person and a company. Coworkers, friends would also just be relationships, connections between those things. Our first cut at this was to have separate relationship documents within our things collection. And this essentially turned out to be a mapping join table. And what it looks like is a little rel document that has the ID of the thing that's on the left of the relationship, the ID of the thing that's on the right, and then a label that basically tells you what that relationship is actually about, what its purpose is. Is it marriage, is it history, whatever. The good news about this is that you get a single atomic insert. Mongo's inserts and updates are atomic at a single document level. If you give him an update statement and it needs to update multiple documents, each document update is atomic, but you're not guaranteed about all those documents being updated. Again, there are no transactions. So in this case, we get the single insert, which is good, so there's no transaction concerns there. The bad point about it was, and we really didn't realize this until we started writing code against it, was it makes what should be a pretty simple query turn into a little bit of messy code. In this case, if I want to find all the things that I'm related to, I'm going to do a query within the things collection. The basis says, find me all the things where I'm either on the left of the relationship or I'm on the right. And that's going to give me a list of those rel documents back. Once I've got that, I need to get a list of the IDs that are on the other side of me within that rel. Once I've got that list at the very bottom, I can go back to Mongo and say, okay, so now give me the things whose IDs are in that list. So I had to go back to Mongo twice with a little bit of our application code sitting in the middle. Not very efficient. And it became pretty clear to us right away that this was not the way that we wanted to go. Especially when you think about we're going to be doing lots more queries than we are inserts or updates, so we need to make sure that our read queries are fast. So our next shot at this was to take the relationships and embed them into the things that are actually part of the relationship. Again, I think when we did our first solution, we were kind of thinking more in the relational model. When we kind of figured out that this is the way that we should do it, we realized, oh, you know what, this is the natural way. If you're dealing with a document data store, you want to take the things that are related to that parent object and nest them inside. Then Mongo can easily do queries down in those nested attributes, return those parent things to you. So again, the real good thing about this was all that code that was on the previous slide boils down to a single line of code now. And it's obviously going to perform much better. So now I'm just telling Mongo, go find me things where I'm on the left of the rel or I'm on the right of the rel, and that's going to return to me the actual thing. Because the relationships are nested inside of the things, this is going to return to me the person object or the company object that's actually part of that relationship. The bad thing is now I've got two documents that I need to update. So if I'm going to do an insert or a delete, now I've got to update thing A and thing B. Well, Mongo's not going to guarantee that both those things are going to get updated. He'll guarantee one of them individually, but he won't guarantee both of them. So that's obviously bad from a transaction concern. So where did we end up with? We now have a hybrid solution where we took the best of both worlds there. So we have a separate rels collection. And this is just like our first solution, except rather than the rel document being inside of the things collection, we moved it into its own collection. And this guy becomes our master source of all of the relationship details. The good news here is that we get the atomic insert. I can create a new relationship. I can delete one atomically. I'm guaranteed that that's going to happen correctly. Part two of the solution comes from solution number two, in that now we have the rels nested within inside of each thing. So this is where we get the good read query performance. The obvious downside here is that when we do an insert or delete, it's now a two-step operation, right? We've now got to update the rels collection here. And then once that's done, we then push those changes out to the individual things, A and B. The good news is that if one of those updates fails to either A or B, we can always go back and rebuild that relationship because we've got it stored up in our RHELS collection here. Sometimes I call this, we're eventually consistent in this case. Right? Some of the database managers use that terminology. If in the off case one of those updates fails, we can detect that and we can go back and then rebuild that relationship. So we've got the best of both worlds. We certainly sacrifice some performance on the inserts and updates, deletes here, but we get the real good query performance, which again, that's what's important to us because we're gonna be doing probably thousands of times more queries than we are gonna be doing inserts or updates. So this was a good compromise for us. I mentioned earlier on that we probably have 8 or 10 different collections. Sorry, question?
So how do you manage the eventually consistent updating?
So in that case, depending on how the update fails, we can catch the exception and go back and try it again if it's something that we think that we could actually fix. The other thing is that we're going to have a bit of an integrity checker that's going to run periodically to kind of troll through our objects and make sure that everything is okay, and it should be able to then stitch everything back together. But at least with that solution, we can do it. Had we stuck with just our second solution, there was no way that we could have done it. Another question?
So what if you wanted to ask a question? Give me all of my friends that work at Company A. We have a similar problem that we're working on, and they end up using Neo for J or store.
Right. Yeah. We thought about using a graph database. Our concern there was that we didn't think we would get the extensibility in the flexible schema that Mongo has. But whenever you look at what we're doing with relationships and things, a graph database makes a lot of sense.
What do you think of the idea of using a graph database and then as one of the attributes of the individual connection going out to Mongo?
Certainly, very, very possible. And I think it's something that we're going to have to think about. It's kind of been sitting in the back of my mind. Maybe if our relationships and our networks grow large enough, we might outgrow Mongo from that standpoint, and we might need to look at moving that into a database that is really meant for that. And so we might end up looking at something like Neo4j just to model the network part of it, and we can use Mongo then for the extensibility part of it, right? Thanks, Mike. Okay, real quick, we do have other collections within the application. I'm not going to talk about these in any detail, but I do want to say that Mongo makes it so easy to create other collections because you don't have to declare any schema right up front. You basically just start writing documents to Mongo with a given named collection, and Mongo will automatically create that collection for you. So there's zero overhead in managing all these collections. So just think about other opportunities. Maybe things that you would normally have written out to flat files, you can now just jam into a Mongo collection, and therefore it is now queryable using the Mongo syntax. It works really, really well for kind of ad hoc and log type stuff. The last thing that I'm going to cover, the cat is not dead, by the way. I showed this to my son the other night, and he goes, "Dad, the cat's dead." I'm like, no, the cat's not dead. The cat is resting. He's resting. So this is the last point that I'm going to cover. Really came about because we are supporting this RESTful interface sitting on top of our business services. We're using the RESTful interface with all of our current UI work. So all of our UI is going through our RESTful interface that then drops into our business services. We're also going to be eventually exposing these RESTful interfaces for development by teams outside of our company. So we might outsource additional application development for a new module that can be added to the application. We might look at having another team do our mobile apps, things like that. So kind of what that meant to us was we're going to have less control over the data that is coming into us. And when you combine that with the fact that Mongo is schema-free, you get the opportunity for garbage coming into your system and getting stored in your database. I was praising schema-free earlier. Well, there is no free lunch. You guys might have thought that the lunch you had earlier today was free. It's not. You paid for it. And this is where we're paying for a little bit of having the ability to not have a schema there. Mongo's not going to stop you from taking a date and putting it into an attribute that really should have a Boolean or vice versa. He doesn't know about your schema. He doesn't care about it. Right? So you've got to be careful. So we looked around and knew that we had to have a way to basically validate all of the data coming into our system so we could prevent getting garbage in. I mentioned that we like JSON, right? So there's this thing called JSON schema that is out there, which basically gives you a way to describe the structure of your documents using JSON. Anybody coming from the XML world who knows DTDs or XML schema, this is the same concept. It's just within JSON. So for us, it fits really well within our world. Real quick example from our person schema. Here you see a person. Note the extends keyword there. So you can have different schema, extend other schema. So if you've got a bit of a hierarchy, you can do that here. In this case, I just broke down the name object into first, middle, last, and suffix. You can specify the type of everything. You can specify whether it's mandatory or not. He also supports, I think, strings, objects, numerics, and Boolean as far as data types go. So we ended up with a separate collection within Mongo of all of our schema. So everything that we have defined within our system, person, company, and so forth, now has a corresponding schema that goes along with it. And everything that basically comes through our business services goes through a validation layer that basically takes the object that's coming in, looks at the JSON schema that it's supposed to match, and throws an exception if it doesn't match. It also gives us the opportunity actually to coerce some of the data coming in into the right data type. If somebody sends us a date in a string, and if we can coerce that into a date field because we know based on the schema that it's supposed to be a date, we can do that. And so that helps us out a lot. Other two uses for it is that once we get customers who are going to be extending our objects, adding employment history and things like that, we can programmatically create schemas for those customers basically. It lets us track exactly what does person look like for customer number one versus customer number two. That will also potentially let us generate the UI to now display these different objects. When we're coding our UI for a person, we don't know about, you know, hobbies because customer number two added that later on. Well, we can look up the schema, know that I've got to display hobbies, and I know that hobbies is a simple list of strings. So now I know that I can generate a little bit of UI for it. So that, in a nutshell, is why MongoDB works for us. And if Chuck Norris endorses it, it's got to be good, right? Summarizing, schema-free. So from our object extensibility standpoint, fits really, really well. Document-oriented, which makes it super easy from a developer and support standpoint to help you kind of visualize the objects that you're dealing with. JSON plugs right into our application stack, plays really nice with pretty much everything else. Scalable, right out of the gate. That was one of the tenets of Mongo whenever 10Gen started with it. Very active product, which makes you feel good, gives you a little bit of warm and fuzzy about this is a database that is not going to be going away anytime soon. It's used by a lot of different folks. And I haven't mentioned that it's free. Go download it, play with it, install it, and run it. It works really well, really, really well for us and lots of other people, and it's hard to beat free these days. So there's a couple of links. These slides are available up on SlideShare, a Twitter handle, and I occasionally write blog articles. I'm not a very active blogger, but occasionally I'll put stuff out there. So any questions, anything else that I can address? Yes?
What's the persistence?
Right. So she's asking, what's the persistence model? So Mongo basically does all of its initial action in memory. and then periodically it'll take what's in memory and then flush it to disk. So that's where it gets a lot of its performance gains from. It's basically dealing with it in memory. So like most database servers, you want to load up your Mongo server with as much RAM as possible. That's where you're going to get most of the benefit from.
Is that configurable?
Yes.
Yes.
Correct. Correct. You can also configure it if you've got what they call a replica set, where you've got one master and then one or more slaves out there. You can configure it so that programmatically, when I do some kind of database operation, don't return to me until that data has been duplicated somewhere else. So if you really have data that you've got to make sure has been persisted somewhere, you can tell Mongo, don't get back to me until I know it's on two of the four slaves that you've got running. But if that's important to you, you can absolutely do it. You can also just do a fire and forget kind of mode also. Throw it at Mongo, come right back to me. I don't know whether it was good or not yet. Yeah.
How is it from an operational perspective? I mean, for relational databases, you can go in, you add indexes, if you want to try to improve your performance based on anything like that in Mongo space?
Yeah. It's certainly not nearly as advanced as the Microsoft SQL Server or Oracle or something, but there are built-in profiling tools which will show you the slow queries. So you can say, write to this Mongo collection. Almost everything that you do in Mongo basically ends up in some kind of collection. So you can tell him to basically write any slow queries, and by slow, I think the default is 100 milliseconds, something like that. So anything that runs over that, he'll basically write it to this file for you. And then you can go back and query it and then look at it. It's got the explain to it also, so you can add that explain operator to your query, and he'll give you his query plan. Am I doing a full table scan, or am I using this index? And it's got full support for indexes also. And you can index pretty much any field in there, no matter how deeply it is nested, which is really, really nice. And he'll index arrays for you also. He'll create an index entry for each unique entry that is in the array, so you can index that field as well. Real quick, side bit, we first deployed without any indexes whatsoever, just to kind of see what would happen and see how it would do. very quickly, it became obvious that we needed to do something, because some of our panels started painting fairly slowly. So the first thing that we did was we added a couple of indexes, and what a dramatic difference. So it's not rocket science that you've got a database, you want to index your data, but Mongo does it really, really well. Yeah?
How about reporting? Does it have reporting capabilities for what's in the database?
No, there's nothing. There's with core Mongo itself, you get the Mongo server itself and the command line that goes along with it. So you can do queries and so forth. There's a couple of tools like Mongo Stat, which will give you status about its performance, how many queries am I doing per second, how many updates, and things like that. But there's no GUI interface whatsoever from that standpoint. I did mention that there's pretty good support from other folks, other groups in the open source world. So there are viewers out there. There's a couple that we use that will help you peer into your database and kind of visualize it for you. Honestly, 90% of the time I'm at the command line just writing queries. Pretty simple. Yes?
Does Mongo have any monitoring tools from operations perspective?
Not directly from Tangen, other than the couple of things that I just mentioned. But they do have, I guess you'd call them plugins, to work with Nagios and a few other of the monitoring frameworks that are out there. So we can basically send data constantly to those frameworks, and then you can write the alert criteria within those frameworks to then either send emails or write log files or whatever. Yeah. Yep. We did look at CouchDB briefly. You're right. That is another document-based data store there. The interesting thing about Couch is that everything that you do is basically a MapReduce. So we weren't really comfortable kind of being forced within that MapReduce world. And when we looked at the query language that Mongo supports, I said that you can't do complex queries, but you can really do quite a bit with them. They have a lot of different operators that will let you do some pretty sophisticated queries down down through the documents. So again, I think, unless Mike, you've got a different recollection, it was really some of the MapReduce.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
And we looked at Couch, we looked at Cassandra, looked at Redis, we looked at MySQL, actually started writing code against the MySQL, and just everything seemed to kind of fit for us towards Mongo. Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Mike Brocious, for talking about MongoDB this year at ETE. Sign up for our news and events emails and you'll be in the know. Head over to chariotsolutions.com/newsletter-signup and fill out the form. We'll send you regular newsletters that include technology news, podcast and blog and screencast links, and information about our upcoming events. The URL again is chariotsolutions.com/newsletter-signup. We'll also post it on our TechCast site, techcast.chariotsolutions.com.